Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we are glad to have you with us. 50 years ago, there were fewer than 100 million obese people in the world and 7 billion people who were malnourished. But there has been a big change, particularly over the past 20 years. Today, there are now 1.6 billion overweight and obese people in the world and about 800 million people who are undernourished. And the question is, well, how has this come about? And some people like to say, well, the problem is that we just don't get enough exercise or we eat too many fast food meals. Our guest for this hour of the show, Barry Popkin, says, yes, in fact, both of those things do contribute. But he also argues that our food system is to blame. He says the fattening of the human race is also the result of an unprecedented collision between our biology on the one hand and technology, globalization, and government policy on the other. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will talk with Barry Popkin about some of what you will find in his recent book, The World is Fat. The subtitle is The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. The book is published by Avery. It's a member of the Penguin Group. It's out now if you want to take a look at the book. Questions and comments certainly are welcome. People like to participate in the conversation. We would welcome that. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that people are brief when they make their comments, ask their questions, and we just ask that so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Barry Popkin is the Carla Smith Chambly Distinguished Professor of Global Nutrition at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also director of the UNC Interdisciplinary Obesity Center and has done a lot of research on understanding people's dietary and physical activity behaviors, why it is those things change over time, and the health consequences of those things. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Popkin, hello.
Hi, thank you for inviting me to come on your program.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. And I think that an important point probably here to start is, as the numbers suggest, that while there has certainly been a lot of attention to the problem of weight here in the United States in our popular media, that in fact this problem, the rise in obesity, along with conditions that go with it, things like high blood pressure and diabetes, these things are becoming problems all over the world, even in developing countries.
That's right. That's right. And at the same time that we had a huge increase in overweight and obesity in the U.S., which is from the 1980s to the present, the last couple decades, really, we had an explosion across the world to the point where there are six countries, Mexico, Egypt, and South Africa, and then the U.S., U.K., and Australia, all with two-thirds or more of adults overweight. So we're not unique. And there are many countries with people as heavy as we have.
Mm-hmm. And I think another important point here, something to consider, and this is, I think this is a really interesting idea about how it is that our inherited biology runs up against how it is that we live, that our physiology, the bodies that we have been with us for a long time, were shaped by conditions that existed a long time ago in the early history of humankind, and that hasn't changed, but the way we live, that definitely has changed, particularly, say, since the end of World War II, but that change has really even accelerated over the last couple of decades. So what it is we're running up against, the way our bodies have been conditioned for a long time to behave, what they want, and that really comes smack up against these other things that I'm sure that we'll talk about, these things that have been changes in how food's produced and how we eat it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. That's really one of my major points, is that and I'll use the beverage issue to really make this true, come home. First of all, we love sweetness. And that love of sweetness is because early hunter-gatherers and early man across the globe needed to have some fruit and some sweet foods to give them some nutrients they didn't have from grains and grasses and seafood and poultry and animal food that they could find wherever they live. So as a result, we desire sweet foods. Then all of a sudden, and secondly, going back for hundreds of thousands of years, all species need water to survive. If you die within 2 or 4 days without water, on the other hand, you die only within a month or 2 months if you don't eat. So water was needed every day, and that's all we had to consume except for babies who had breast milk. And so after breastfeeding was over, by 2 to 4 years of life, all you had was water. You needed it to survive. If you didn't consume it daily, you died. But food was seasonal. So for hundreds of thousands of years, actually only till 300 or 400 years ago, we had seasonal hunger throughout the globe. So our bodies developed a way to store food, eat it whenever we could get it, and have to at the same time drink all the time. You didn't want to drink water, which was all that was available, and cut your food intake. So our mechanism for beverage intake, the fact that when we drink water, we don't cut down the food we take in, was developed over hundreds of thousands of years. All of a sudden, in the last 10,000 years, really in the last 70 to 100 years, we have caloric beverages that we're consuming a lot of. And we've increased, just in the last 20 or 30 years, in the U.S., 227 calories per day that we are drinking from caloric beverages. And we're not, and we don't cut our food down when we drink beverages. So that's where modern industry and modern marketing and even our subsidies of sugar in our government sector have led us to all of a sudden change from water to caloric beverages. We're not equipped to cut the calories. They just add to our diet and we drink them.
Yeah, and this is something I know is very important for you, something that, and also I think probably is something that might surprise people a little bit if they think, well, what are the really big contributors to the imbalance of calories, not only the number of calories, but where the calories come from? I think this is probably something that maybe people really wouldn't think of right away.
That's right. That's right. When you drink, you just don't think anything of it. It's just there to drink it. That's how it used to be when we had water only. But now that it's Pepsi or a Bud or a glass of milk or orange juice or Gatorade or energy drinks or all the millions of new beverages that come every day, they give you for every glass 100 to 200 calories. And what happens? You drink, the average kid and adult drinks 3 to 5 times a day or at least caloric beverages. That's a big increase in calories, and it's all energy imbalance. We do not cut our food down when we drink any caloric beverage, nor when we drink water.
And I think here, again, this is something where, and I'm sure that it gets, you become, for people who are in the beverage industry and perhaps also who are in agribusiness and maybe also legislators who represent agricultural states, you become a controversial figure here because you have also argued that our policy, among other things, has made sugar cheap and made sweetened products cheap. And so the kinds of things that we're talking about, these kinds of high-calorie sweetened beverages, a lot of them are very, very inexpensive.
That's right. That's right. So, by the way, I'm a Midwesterner by birth. I spent most of my life in Wisconsin. And so I certainly understand the agricultural side of things. We could never even get skim milk when I was a kid, and whole milk and butter were very expensive. So I understand agricultural pressures. And what happened, the first experiment station in the world in the 1800s was to produce cheap sugar. And our government and the United Kingdom and other countries in Europe have put, and other countries since then, in the Jamaica, Cuba, South Africa, hundreds of millions of dollars, in fact billions, into creating cheaper sugar varieties. And, of course, more recently, high fructose corn syrup, which comes from corn. All these are sugars. All of these affect obesity in the same way. Every one of these adds calories when we drink it. Now, if it were only milk, milk is good if you have skim milk and not whole milk. You don't get that extra saturated fat, and we need some of the nutrients. But we didn't drink that much of it. But now that we've added these caloric beverages, we're drinking an awful lot of it, and that's really been shaped between industry and government policy. We made it cheap. We subsidized it. We actually give the industry, from write-offs of all sorts, money to lobby for these subsidies, and it's coming back to haunt us. But it's more haunting us not on sugar. It's haunting us on the fact that we eat very few fruits and vegetables and very little beans, which used to be very important in our diet 50, 100 years ago. Instead, since 1950, we put literally hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies into animal foods, which are, you know, corn and soybean, as you know from Illinois, mm-hmm. are really cheaper. And beef today, in real terms, is 20% of what it was in 1960, if you deflate it and deal with it globally. So we have made it so cheap to buy beef and pork and poultry, and we have increased at the same time the real cost of fruits and vegetables and beans and other healthier foods. So we've distorted the prices. It was great for our farmers at one point, but they could equally make a profit on other things. We just kind of changed the whole equation across the globe doing that.
Yeah, and again, to go back to the issue of our preferences as well, it doesn't help that we have these preferences that go back millions of years,
right.
literally, for sweet and fatty foods, and we're kind of turned off by things that are bitter, so maybe it's not surprising that you'd rather have a cheeseburger and fries and a big soft drink than you'd like to eat a big plate of broccoli. There's anything wrong with,
that's right.
with broccoli,
of course. And the food industry recognize that, and in fact, if you go to your supermarket, whatever kind you go to, whether it's a Whole Foods or a local chain or a Walmart, you will find 3/4 of the products have sugar added, and you will be surprised how many kinds of sugars. And then when it comes to fat, clearly the French fry history. You know, we only made them at home when I was a kid, and we had them once a month. Today, people eat them for every meal, and it's just all fat with a little bit of potato.
Okay. Let me very quickly introduce our guest, Barry Popkin. He's professor of global nutrition at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He also directs the UNC Interdisciplinary Obesity Center and has done a lot of research on the issue of dietary and physical activity behaviors, things that cause them to change, their health consequences. He's the author of the recently published book, The World is Fat, The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about something else that I'm sure that is often raised when people are looking for explanations for the rising weight of the world. They say, well, a big part of this is lack of physical activity. People don't have jobs that require that so much anymore. People aren't doing it voluntarily. We have settled into this very sedentary lifestyle, and a big part of the problem is that, you know, it's calories in and calories out, and, well, we're not doing very much to consume the calories that go in.
You're absolutely correct. And those declines are serious, and a part of the obesity problem in the U.S. and around the world certainly is attributable to those declines. However, to stop weight gain and prevent future obesity and prevent all the problems, we need activity, but that won't solve it. It's our diet. It's so much easier to stop drinking one Coke or Pepsi than it is to run a mile or the equivalent. And so it will be hard to get people to move the way we moved in the 50s and earlier, but we can certainly get people to start exercising and moving some, and we need to do that for our health. But the problem of obesity and diabetes are really going to be solved more by getting people to eat less, drink more water, drink less caloric beverages, and stop eating 7-10 times a day. Eat your meals, have one or two, have a snack, but don't eat constantly.
Yeah. I think that's an important point, because I think people say, well, yes, it's about calories consumed and calories burned. And then they'd say, well, obviously that means that we need to have more exercise. And I think you would say, a lot of people would say, well, sure, yes, indeed, it means we have to do more exercise. But there is also this issue of the number of calories that we are consuming. And, you know, there's only so much physical activity that people can or willing to do. So not only you still have to work on, you can't just work on the one side and say exercise more, burn more calories will be okay. You also have to look at the total number of calories, and I'm sure that you also want to look at where those calories come from, but you want to look at the number of calories consumed on the other side as well.
Yes, you're correct. And there's two points there. One, for the first 15 or 20 years that overweight was really starting to increase from the late 1980s to the end of the century, the food industry kept saying the whole problem is physical activity. But even they realized, and of course we had to work hard on that, that it was diet that was going to have to change. Mm-hmm. You can't burn up the extra 200 calories a day with activity. You can't get that out of kids, out of adults, out of elderly. And everybody's gaining weight in our country constantly. And it's all because we've increased in every age, gender, group, the calories we're consuming at a time when our activity's been going down. So we've got to change the way we eat.
Yeah. We have a caller to bring into the conversation on our line number one. They're in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, this is a very interesting conversation. I studied Japan, actually, and something that I find interesting about Japan is, because I live there a lot, and the Japanese like food more than Americans. I mean that literally. They like food more than Americans, but they have less than 4% obesity. And what I tell people is the Japanese people like food more than Americans. That's why they're less fat. And what I mean by that is, as with a lot of French people, they like variety in their food. They like small amounts of lots of different kinds of foods. They enjoy that. Whereas Americans, in my own experience, and certainly my family is from Ohio, you know, if you have one or two things on the at dinner, that's pretty much plenty. And no one really, there isn't a culture of cuisine and enjoying food. And I really wonder whether that, in addition, of course, to the economic factors and the kinds of things that are being advertised and so forth, that's related to part of the problem.
Yeah, I think these are the very important comments, and let me talk about Japan first. There are a couple things about the Japanese cuisine, and there are really two age cohorts in Japan. Those that are like over 40, really over 50, that eat very healthy and eat traditional Japanese, and it's a low-fat, high-protein diet with a reasonable amount of vegetables and fibrous kind of foods. Then you've got younger Japanese who have started shifting to eat the way Americans do. And in fact, you might not know this, but every beverage that gets put on the world market, 9 out of 10 of them get tested first in Japanese. Japanese youth, if they go for a fad, they know the world will, because they're very picky and they very faddish. So they're changing and they're getting fatter, and they're not going to look so different. But you're indeed correct that the older people in Japan, and even more in South Korea, where they're thinner than Japan,
right,
they eat a huge variety. But what's interesting in South Korea, and it'll come back on France, in South Korea from after the war until the turn of the century, the women had 2 weeks of training to learn to cook traditional Korean vegetable dishes, and they eat tons of it. They eat the most vegetables in Asia, and that's important. But now let's go to France. The French really had great portion control, and variety was important, but portion control was critical. And in my book, I talk about the history of that, and that began at the early 1900s when actually, it was a huge movement to control infant feeding, and they didn't like to breastfeed. They weighed and measured everything that the infant was fed, and then they started training women, called the puriculture movement, and then they started training them for preschoolers, and it shifted over. So women had to go for a week before they had a child of government training in every place in the country to be trained in weighing and measuring every dish to make sure they didn't overfeed their children. out of that came huge portion control in Japan and France, which has only started being changed in the last decade. And the French are freaked out. They were gaining weight. They actually just banned a year ago all vending machines in schools because the kids were getting fat. And they have a huge program that they funded that started in a few communities and now is up to several hundred, where they go in the government in a massive way into communities and they have them create community obesity prevention programs. And so they have taken this. They also banned TV, food and beverage advertisement on TV to kids under 18. They really were afraid by the obesity they were getting, and they've attacked it. So they had a good history, and then as soon as they saw the problem, they tackled it. We haven't either.
Just one other question. The Japanese, I've noticed, even with the youth, because I've been in their McDonald's and elsewhere, that they seem still not to drink pop, and they eat much less sweet. How should I put it?
Their right, but if you go see, they're drinking a lot of caloric beverages today. They are sugared, but they aren't as sweet.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so it's changing. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to line number two. This is someone in Champaign also. Hello.
Hi. Well, I noticed also, I mean, like, you go to the gas station. I wanted to get some ice cream one day and went in there. They changed all the sizes to larger sizes and stuff like that. When did this trend start coming in? And I have another question, and I'll just hang up and listen. With Monsanto spraying things like Roundup and things like that, they've had to take in something out of the plants so the Roundup doesn't kill like the soybeans, but kills the weeds around it. Those enzymes are missing. Is that a big part of this too?
Okay, I cannot address the latter exactly. Clearly, the food that we're consuming is enormously different than even what I consumed in the 50s and 60s as a child, in the 40s and 50s, I should say. Yes, that's different, but I can't attribute it to one thing. And that's only very recent, the newest Monsanto stuff, so I just don't think that's the problem. Now, let's go back to your other point. It is indeed an issue. And it began in some ways with McDonald's figuring out supersizing and portion sizing, and they figured out a way that it was really better to sell that, and people liked it. From that time to the present, the industry have realized packaging costs them a hell of a lot more than the food ingredients. In fact, food is 10, 20, 30% of our budget of everything we buy, depending on the product. And most of what's in the products that we buy are packaging and processing and marketing. And so, yeah, if you go into those, you can't find 4 or 8 ounce bottles of anything. You can't find small sandwiches or ice cream cones unless you go to a gourmet place. And that's just for the reason that I noted. It's cheap. It doesn't cost them any more to give you 10 ounces of food than or beverage than it does to give you 1 ounce. And so, you know, people like it, and they've told us we should like it, and we've learned to like it, and we want our bargains. So,
well, if you go to the grocery store, if it has diet on it, or something that's supposed to be less in calories, it costs more.
That's right. And initially, the same thing happened with skim milk, which was healthier for Americans. Now, of course, it doesn't cost more, but that's all correct because they can sell it, and that. It's starting to change, but you're absolutely correct that it was a very smart promotion. You know, it's cheaper to buy a bag of Twinkies that serves 100 people, and then the kid just sits there and consumes it all day rather than the little packages that they used to consume.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And you know, I think it's really, you make an important point here about portion inflation, that it's, and I think that it's true, that it's not just that they're not losing money, they're actually making money. And it goes back to your comments about soft drinks. I think certainly it's true there that the raw materials that go into making the beverage are very small. So if they can get you to buy a bigger one and spend an extra quarter, maybe it'll cost them another nickel in the syrup that goes into that. But for the seller, there's 20 cents of pure profit just getting you to buy a bigger size.
Yeah, in that Coke you buy that you pay a dollar for, there's 5 cents worth of cost for syrup and other stuff at Mac. But it's very interesting. A company based in Chicago, Kraft, really tried to deal with that portion thing. They've tried creating 100-calorie snack packs for kids. What we don't know is, and they thought it was good, and it was a good deed to do it, but we don't know if the parents are buying three of those to give the kid or just one. If the kid's having one, that's good and healthy. Kids only had one snack in the 1950s maximum. Today, the average child and adult in America consumes 3.5 snacks a day. So we've just gone, but you know, bananas, when it comes to the number of times we eat, we're like constantly eating.
Yeah, and one of the things I think you also point to, again, in the mix is the increase in people going out, people eating outside of the home, and I'm sure that that also portion inflation there tends to, it's changed what we think of as what's a serving food you have to have.
And what I showed in a few papers I published is that the portion sizes at restaurants and at home are now the same. So we've been trained by the restaurants to want to eat more. But portion sizes would in of themselves not have done it if it wouldn't be for the caloric beverages and the fact that we used to consume 5-10% of our daily intake from snacks. Today we consume 25-30% of it, and we're eating constantly, so we don't even get hungry anymore.
Yeah. We're at a midpoint here. We're going to take some more calls and continue to talk with our guest, Barry Popkin. First, we'll just take a moment to pause so we can do this test of the emergency alert system. It's just a test.
Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was...
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Let me again quickly introduce our guest, and we'll take some more calls. Barry Popkin is a professor of global nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He directs the UNC Interdisciplinary Obesity Center and has done a lot of research on people's dietary and physical activity behaviors, how they change, certainly how they have changed over time, particularly the last couple of decades, and what that means for the health of those individuals. He's the author of a recently published book. The title of his book is The World is Fat, The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. The book is out now. Avery is the publisher. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with somebody here who is on a cell phone on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if the guest is aware of any initiatives within our own government to recognize the pricing structure that contributes to people making poor choices, and then the subsidies that contribute to making things cheaper, and its relationship to our healthcare costs. I recall hearing someone from the Kaiser Foundation saying that 75% of healthcare costs are caused by, you know, five preventable conditions, three of which are diet related, like diabetes, heart attacks, and general heart disease. And I just wonder if he's aware of an initiative to kind of focus on all of this at the same time, and advocacy groups that, if the government isn't aware of it, that are at least focusing on this.
Yeah, a very good question. And I was involved and had some small meetings with the Senate staff, and Harkin was very aware of this. And there were huge pushes to change some of the subsidy structure, and to in fact, even to regulate what went on in the schools and with school feeding. Most of that didn't succeed because we have such entrenched subsidies right now. We added a little extra money for fruits and vegetables, nothing really for beans, and it's all trivial what was added compared to what exists. So it indeed we haven't succeeded, but in yes, there are a whole cluster of senators that understand this. In fact, we had 24 senators that signed, said they wanted to pass a bill that would really control vending in the schools. But that, again, was defeated by Pepsi and some other industry that wanted a really loose law, the guidelines they have, which really allows all sorts of junk beverages in the schools. So we've tried. We had huge organizations working with the Senate on this, and the lobbyists beat us out. They have more money than we do.
Could you maybe recommend the top, you know, maybe two groups that the person could join if they wanted to, you know, give it another try? Can you think of?
Well, I'll tell you one group that certainly works on this: the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and they are doing a lot. I work on it directly with the Senate staff, and I really don't know other nonprofit groups working on it. If you email me or something, I can look into it, but I can't think of it right now.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to a caller here in Piatt County on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to give a completely unscientific but pretty accurate observation, and it's been over 10 years ago. We were at a Club Med on a fringe island, and this was even before such incredible consciousness about obesity, but I was shocked because everything is paid for before you go to the club. And at breakfast, I just noticed that Americans would take enormous amounts of food, and even food that they wouldn't necessarily eat. I mean, toast and bacon and eggs and juice, and it was just a lot of food. And then they would sit and talk and be very gregarious, and the French would wander down and have a croissant with a very small amount of butter and a very small amount of jam and a huge cup of cafe au lait and not talk at all. And I just noticed this over the time that I was there. Then a group of Venezuelans came in, and it was the same thing, just enormous amounts of food, and, you know, beer was free at lunch. And it was just interesting culturally to see how we react to great amounts of food that are paid for. And then I read something vaguely about that aspect of hoarding, you know, that we tend to hoard our food in times of plenty, perhaps. So I was making the connection. So it's just an observation, and I thought I'd comment on that. I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right. Any thoughts about that?
Very good observation, and it's all true about corrupt. But if she had gone to the Club Med 50 years before, Americans would have eaten just like the French. And so what's happened is a huge shift in norms and behavior that's really been kind of promoted and induced in some ways by a whole lot of marketing of all sorts of sectors of the food industry.
All right, let's talk with someone who is calling from Indiana. This is our line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I was listening to some of the comments, and it seems as though there is a feeling that the government needs to step in and take action to control our inability to control ourselves. And I was thinking about the many restaurants that I go to, and some guy back in the kitchen prepares a meal for me, and I feel that I don't have to eat what they prepare. I eat what I want, stop, leave it. And if they want to prepare that amount, that's their wish, but not necessarily mine. I'm not sure that anything that we can do in the legislature can truly control what people eat. We need to be working toward more self-control in eating as well as in other areas.
Your points are well taken, and it's clearly an important perspective. When only the U.S. was overweight, I used to think it was gluttony and sloth, and, you know, we just it's everything you're saying. We just didn't have the control and we were just lazy. But as I saw that the same changes happened to hundreds of millions of people all over the globe, I saw that they were getting this cheap water with sugar in it, and who wouldn't want that over regular water? They were getting all these other kinds of foods made available in remarkably cheap ways, and it's very seductive. And then I remembered how cigarette smoking was in the 50s. Cigarettes were dirt cheap, and then in the 60s we started introducing taxes, and we actually cut smoking down from 75% of Americans to about 25%. We've gotten more income. It's gone up. It's going down now with more taxes. But the point is, we really cut it with taxation and regulation. We did the same thing with car seatbelts. People refused to use car seatbelts until we required it, even though it was going to kill their kids. So, you know, there's sometimes we need public regulations because the environment around us just is so powerful. Today we have $100 billion of advertisement all around us in this country saying, drink this, eat this. It is very hard. Every place you move, a child sees food advertised and beverages advertised and sold. What do? If you don't somehow change some of the environment. I've watched my Chinese. I've gone from in this group I've followed for 20 years, these 20,000 Chinese in 200 communities throughout the country. They've gone from no obesity to a third of adults overweight. It's just all this stuff around them that's seductive and is telling them this is the way to be sexy. So I think it's going to be very hard as a globe to deal with this problem unless we change some of the prices and some of the regulations about advertisement and so forth.
Yeah. You know, I think this is very interesting because it was not all that long ago I was talking with someone here from the University of Illinois who was an economist who was particularly interested in health issues. And this was the obesity problem was the main focus of our conversation. And he really made he made the argument that regulation just won't work. You know, I asked him questions about, for example, some of the places where they've tried to regulate the health and content of fast food, and various cities have tried to pass various ordinances about things. And he said he would have none of that. He said, really, he feels that the only way that effectively the problem can get at is essentially through public education. That is to try to tell people what the right thing to do is and then simply rely on them to do it because it's the right thing. And of course, we know that really overall doesn't work all that well in other areas. But I guess I wonder what you think about particularly about the role of education and how far we can get by trying to give people a very strong message about what a healthy diet is and then hope that they'll do it.
Well, here's the problem. We spend $1 million or $2 million a year on public advertising about food, and the industry spends $100 billion. There's no way, and the same thing happened with cigarettes before, there's no way we can offset their wealth of money spent on advertising. We either need to change the climate and change the environment of advertising, or education is irrelevant. You can't tell a kid in school, drink this because it's healthy for you, and they turn on the computer, they turn on the TV, they walk down the streets, and all they see is drink, 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 Pepsi or what have you. So it's impossible without regulating to truly address the problem, and it's impossible without changing the prices. And I'm also a PhD in economics, like the colleague that you talked with, and I feel that in cigarettes, the price changes really mattered. And I have research that will be coming out within a half year showing the exact same thing when it's published for taxing soft drinks, among other things. Okay. It would change what people drink.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Barry Pompkin. He's the Carla Smith Chambly Distinguished Professor of Global Nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is an agricultural economist by his training. He's also director of the UNC Interdisciplinary Obesity Center and has done a lot of research looking at people's dietary and physical activity behaviors, how those things have changed, particularly over the last couple decades, what that means for the health not only of Americans but people around the globe. And the basic point is that we have seen a very significant change in the number of overweight people in the world. 50 years ago, it was something like 100 million people overweight around the world, and today that number tops 1.6 billion. He writes about this in his book, The World is Fat, The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. We have another caller, also someone here from Indiana, on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Interesting program. Couple of questions, please, or issues. Number one, the effect of medicine, particularly for diabetics. Actos, which seems to retain a lot of fats and other food items in our system, the contribution it's making to overweight. The second issue is the upscale restaurants. A friend of mine works for a food service company and makes deliveries, and it's interesting the comment he's made that every high-scale restaurant that he goes into, they've always got a slab of lard around that they keep putting into their foods.
Well, I don't know, Professor Popkin, if you really have a response for either of those things.
No, I really don't. I mean, I eat episodically barbecue in the South and other foods. And when I go, we used to go to some Southern black places in the 60s and 70s. They used a lot of lard. But I just haven't seen that kind of world in so long that I just can't speak to it.
All right. Is the issue of the kind of fats we use and consume, is that an issue?
Well, fat is fat in terms of calories. So whether it's trans fats or vegetable oils, it's going to give us the same amount of calories. Lard and butter have saturated oils in them, which are worse for heart disease, just like trans fats were. And but other than the fact that for heart disease and certain other conditions, it's better to have healthier oils, the reality is for obesity, they're all the same. And in fact, when we got rid of trans fat, sometimes to replicate it, we got a little more oil to our diet. So the kind of oil doesn't affect whether you're fat or thin. The kind of oil affects your heart disease patterns, and it's very important, but it won't make you thinner.
All right. I think that's probably about the best response we can make. Let's go back here to someone in where we are here in Champaign. This would be line one. Hello.
Okay, I just wanted to make a statement. I think that it's hopeful because I think the public is beginning to demand healthier food. I know that Kentucky Fried Chicken has a grilled chicken now that you can get. And the more the public demands it, the more we'll get it. And then I think some cities like New York use all the right kind of fat in their restaurants. Anyway. I do think the cigarette tax has helped quite a bit. I agree with that, too. That's all I have to say.
Let me just add one or two points. Those were all very good comments. Yes, there's a segment of the population that's demanding healthy food and getting it, and there's a lot of pressure on our fast food industry to create healthier foods, and McDonald's has led the way, a local company, and some other fast food companies really dragged their feet and are now starting to respond, but it's not reaching all of America, and it won't. New York City did another thing. They required the calories to be labeled high up on the signs of the McDonald's and Burger King's and Wendy's, and it seems to have had some effect. And New York City is trying with New York State to push a beverage tax of 18%. They kind of failed because of a weak governor, but we're going to see it in a couple other states, and we're going to start to see these changes just as we did for cigarettes because we need it. Oh, our economy is going to just go under from the health care costs from obesity.
Mm. And that's something that I think you point to as being a real concern, not just for the United States, but for the rest of the world, as we start to see, as we said at the beginning, even in developing countries, increasing weight with then the problems that go with it, things like heart disease and hypertension and diabetes. It sounds like we could be on the brink of having a really serious problem around the world with diabetes.
That's right. India's going to have, within 15 years, 100 million diabetics, a really poor country with half of the rural population malnourished. So these are truly big problems. And the bigger issue to realize is obesity debilitates you. It doesn't kill you. Smoking kills you. In some ways, smoking is cheaper. It kills you. You die. You don't keep going for health care costs. Obesity, you get osteoarthritis. You get heart disease. You get diabetes. You get all these diseases. And if you get the drugs for them, you don't prevent the problem. You just keep taking more drugs and the medical costs skyrocket. So we are going to be a lot less healthy. Our kids are going to live less shorter lengths of time than the adults because of child obesity today.
Hmm. Well, you've talked a little bit about the price that we paid for a policy that creates cheap food, particularly cheap sugar and cheap meat and animal products. So that's an issue. And we've talked about the educational thing. And I still think that part of the problem is that if you ask people what constitutes a healthy diet, I think that maybe a lot of people could give you some fairly good response. I mean, it's not like they haven't heard the issue. But then if you ask them what sort of diet they have, and if they're being honest with you, they'll probably tell you all of the things that they are doing wrong. So, we have policy going in one direction, and we have education going another direction. Other than trying to get the message out there better, and then also maybe creating some incentives to eat healthier and doing that with the price structure for things, maybe making Pepsi more expensive and vegetables less. Are there some other things that we haven't touched on that you would say, here are some other things that would help?
Let me talk about a couple. Yeah. When in the 50s and 60s, every school had water coolers and no vending machines. Mm-hmm. All around the public, everywhere, there were water coolers when you walked or did things. Today, it's vending machines selling, and water is more expensive or as expensive as soft drinks. We need water to come back into our diets, and we need to get rid of. But we also are going to need to control advertising reaching everyone, just like we did for cigarettes. We have so much marketing on everywhere for junk food, sugary beverages. You can't offset it unless we regulate it, and we're going to have to do that. Countries have started. There are 5 or 8 countries that are just banning certain kinds of TV advertising. We are kind of the captive of industry right now and haven't taken these on, but we're going to be pretty desperate, and we're going to be doing it. And so I think doing the food side is critical. I also think we need our kids to learn lifetime secrets of activity. And Illinois is the best state in America for physical activity in the schools. Now from grade 6 through high school, kids have to move and do some physical activity. No other state has a full age spectrum policy. We got rid of physical activity. Every school in America essentially gave it at most once a week, and the kids never sweated. So that's another side we need to get people to move again. So mm-hmm. There are many things we can talk about to do in the way of diet and activity. The real question is getting the wherewithal in our government. And we have some industry leaders who would like to do things, but they don't have a level playing field. McDonald's introduces salads, and Burger King and Hardee's come in and introduce 1,000-calorie drinks and sandwiches. It won't work. They take away each other's or create new markets and lose the other markets. So we need every one of them to have the same level playing field, which means working out with the government ways to do some things to make it cheaper to eat healthy.
All right. Let's talk with at least one more caller here. Champagne, this is line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm going to be quick, but there is one dimension I want to raise, and most of the discussion so far seems to view these health-conscious decisions as a matter of choice. I have a demographic group that may not do this as a matter of choice, but as a matter of necessity. Those are the low-income, generally minority members of inner cities and even smaller cities who, quote, don't have fruit stores or grocery stores in their community. And when they do have them, there's not a healthy supply of fresh fruits and vegetables. And really, the type of enterprise that predominates in their low-income communities are generally fast food places.
That's right. That's correct. There are two things about that. We call those food deserts, and they're in rural and urban America. We don't know if we build it, they will change their diet, because it's still cheaper to buy junk food than it is to buy fruits and vegetables. And so until we make fruits and vegetables cheaper than junk food, and you're poor, you'll buy the calories at the cheapest level. So that's one problem. But the other is we don't have access in lots of populations, and we have zoning and all sorts of things which makes it easier to get some kinds of junk into low-income worlds than others. I was a community organizer in the Midwest and worked between Chicago, Detroit, and Milwaukee in the 60s, and even then I saw that. And today it's really pretty miserable. There's huge areas of Chicago and other urban areas, and there's some rural areas in Illinois, just can't find cheap, healthy food readily available.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks. Before we finish, I'm just really curious. You know, we've talked about this. I think people here, the focus is going to be on this country, but you, I think, want to get across to the people the idea that this is a worldwide problem. And having spent time outside of the United States, is there some place where you say you could tell a quick story that would just illustrate how this is, in fact, happening everywhere?
Well, take Mexico. Hmm. Mexico in the 1980s had very little overweight. 71% of Mexican women, 66% of Mexican men are overweight. But more remarkable, it's going up so fast. In 1999, they consumed half the caloric beverages we did. Today, every age group from 1 to 60 consumes more than we do. They doubled their caloric beverages intake in 7 years. Between 1999 and 2006, because of huge promotion and cheap costs of all these sugary beverages.
Mm. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. For people who would like to read more on the subject, you can look for Barry Popkin's recent book. It's titled The World is Fat: The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. Our guest is Carla Smith Chambly, Distinguished Professor of Global Nutrition at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he directs the UNC Interdisciplinary Obesity Center. And Professor Popkin, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.